Yo, and welcome back to Ride Better, Faster, a show about cycling training and racing. I'm Damien Roos. In this episode, I sit down with fellow reviewers of the Cycling Science Digest to discuss a couple of papers that were released in February 2021. And in the chaser, we talk about the future of training platforms, well, at least what might happen after we hit rock bottom. So every month I publish the Cycling Science Digest with the latest and best articles from the month before, and this month the publication got a boost in credibility and perspective from two new contributors, Jason Boynton, PhD, and Cyrus Monk, BS. And after finishing this month's issue, we got on a call and went over a bunch of the articles that were reviewed with some extra insights into the context of the science and the practical applications of the interventions. We started out with the study on bicarb soda for endurance performance and adding sprints into endurance training. Okay, let's just roll with the bicarb one because it is, I think it's interesting as well. I don't know if you've actually used it beforehand. I've tried it, but I haven't tried it in a performance way.
No, I've never used it because, and this is another promising thing I found out of the study, I've never used it because I'm so scared of messing around with my gut. Because you don't notice when your gut's going well in during a race period, but you definitely notice when it's not going well. And like that's, yeah, for me, I've always thought, well, I'm doing short time trials, like maybe 3 a year, and then the rest of my races are all over the 2 hour mark, like the important ones. So for me, the benefits have always just been shown in these studies to be for short races with a high sort of dependence on the anaerobic system rather than aerobic system. So for me, I've always thought, why would I mess around with my gut? Where obviously, if it gets to the point where you have to stop on the side of the road to get rid of everything, then you're losing the race. Like whatever marginal gain you would have got from the bicarb is redundant.
But high downside, low upside. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But the promising thing from this was, out of the 11 trained cyclists, so again, yeah, relatively reasonably high VO2 max 63, but they none of them had any gastric upset, which was really promising. And so basically what they're doing here is just really small doses regularly, so it was all done to body weight. So 150 milligrams per kilogram prior, and then 150 milligrams per kilogram during, per kilogram body weight, that is, during a 3 hour race. And then, so the 3 hour race, they kind of, you can see it in the study design, they kind of just basically broke it up into six different 30 minute blocks at different percentages of lactate threshold. The thing they noted in the race was there was never any point where they were going over lactate threshold, which obviously doesn't replicate a bike race that well. And that's where you would expect to see some of that buffer that the bicarb would create might be used up in a bike race, for example, following attacks or going deep on a climb in the middle of a race. So whether you would still have that benefit in the 90-second sprint they did at the end. But yeah, it was a fairly high increase there for the final sprint. So improved mean power by 3%, which is, if you're looking at actual the numbers for someone sprinting, if that's improving by 3%, that's going to be a pretty big thing at the end of a bike race. And just really small dosages of the bicarb every half hour. But that's definitely something that is manageable in a bike race. I think that's more manageable for professionals than amateurs or even like national level riders, where it's difficult to sort of have every rider getting the bottle at the right time. Whereas from my experience riding in a world tour team, like you literally can say at this kilometer of the race, I want this drink bottle in my hand, and they'll find a way to make that happen. So that could definitely be something that's used by cyclists in the pro peloton and teams. We could see them actually supplementing with that for those Tour de France days where it's everyone rolling along for the whole day at a really low intensity, so they're not going to be eating into that buffer, and then they've got that buffer there at the end for the 1 minute effort essentially that the end of those stages end up being.
Do you have to load for it? I don't remember whether you do or not.
No, yeah, so it was loading for the 90 minutes before the race.
And but not then, not days during, before though.
Not days before at all. No. So just before the chosen race. And it was
that
only
that makes it pretty easy to try out, I think. Like it makes it a real option to just throw in to a race.
Yeah, for sure. And the promising thing was if you can sort of stick to this protocol that they've got outlined of the 150 milligrams per kilogram body weight before. So basically 300 milligrams per kilogram. So it's going to be, just doing the maths in my head, for your 70 kilo rider, it's going to be about 2 grams of bicarb. If you can sort of space that out so that you're never having too much at one point, it's going to be pretty easy for people to put in their bins and have a go at.
So you're going to test it?
I think if there's a race that I see that's going to be just the steady effort and then a sprint at the end, then I think I'd definitely have a go. I think for me, it's harder to test here in Australia, as I said, because if I'm just getting bins from someone's mum on the side of the road, which is the standard one here, it's going to be harder for them to organise that I'm not picking up someone else's and they're getting a bin that's got bicarb in it and thinking, what's going on here? But definitely in Europe, especially if we're doing a circuit race where you can organise, right, I want these bottles on this lap, this lap, this lap, so you can actually control the dosage, then it's definitely something I would try out from the results of this study.
Yeah, I'm actually one of the like world experts of bicarb is friends with Chris Abyss, my advisor. So I got to just have a chat with him, but because it's nutrition and it's different, like I never haven't had a chance to really dive into this stuff because of the side effects with it. But if I remember right, they were talking about, he was talking about skin application, like patches for this stuff.
And cream is another one.
It'll be interesting. I don't know if they have research on that yet.
I think it hasn't been shown to be a...
So if that works, you can bypass...
But it hasn't been shown so far, I don't think.
Oh, okay.
There's so many just anecdotally, like crazy amount of people using, like Lactigo is one of the brands, but just this cream that they're rubbing on their legs before stages, like that. I've seen teammates rubbing it on their legs before a 5 hour race, and I sort of have, like, they've obviously don't understand the mechanism behind what's going on, but sort of the thing I always worry about with the creams is, and the topical stuff is, because you can't put it on during a race. And my thing with that is, if you're buffering to the point where you can go deeper than you normally would be able to, so do basically like more damage to the muscle earlier in a race, you're going to pay for that later on. So that's from a practical standpoint for me, that's why I've always avoided it in endurance races, because I was thinking, well, like there's a reason we have pain there, and a lot of long distance cycling is just managing that pain to a point where, right, I'm going to not go as hard at this point in the race because I still want to be good at the end. Whereas for like from basically just thinking about it logically, if you're going deeper earlier in the race because you've got that buffer there, then it's you're gonna pay for it later on. And then, as Damien said, the research for the topical application isn't there from what I've found. So there's a lot more promising stuff for the oral taking of it.
Mm-hmm. I guess it'd be really interesting to if they did see an effect. I guess the next thing would be to look at would be like a pacing study on like a nice long hour, 2 hour time trial, just see if people go out too hard and or something like that. So yeah, it's something to consider.
After the break, should you add sprints into your endurance training rides? This episode is brought to you by Open Road, the indoor riding app I've been using all winter. And if you're ready for a change of scenery on your indoor trainer, then this is the app for you. Open Road is definitely worth a try because it gives you unparalleled panoramic views indoors, the only app on the market to use professionals to film the rides like it was for the cinema. This means with Open Road, you can enjoy panoramic views that puts you right in the center of the scenery like nowhere else. Then there's the rides. I think each country should be paying Open Road because after every ride, I want to go to these places and visit them. They have a library of unique rides from all over the world that are planned and curated in great detail. Finally, they are the only app offering you to cross the Pyrenees on the world's longest indoor ride. It's a killer challenge where you can ride till you drop and pick it up where you left off each time. As far as price goes, it's affordable even with your other indoor app subscriptions at €3.99 or $4.79 a month, billed annually. And to check out the videos and the app, head over to bikethe.world for more information or to sign up. Cool. Let's roll into your favorite paper, Jason.
Like favorite paper of all time?
Yeah. No.
I'm trying to. It was the sprint one with the carbohydrates. So it would be in your nutrition section, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Very last paper. There we go. All right. So this one, my initial impression of this paper was kind of, I feel like a lot of times that lab studies kind of go off because they can, as opposed to like offering a whole anything like super, super practical. And what they were, there was enough studies already to kind of show that after exercise, if you depleted carbohydrate or restricted carbohydrate consumption, then it wouldn't change these molecular markers for mitochondrial biogenesis. And their thought was they kind of got overly into the molecular side of things, and they wanted to see if it would change if you added in sprints into the exercise intervention. That basically what they were doing using the exercise intervention for was to deplete carbohydrate stores. And so they wanted to add the sprints in to see if it kind of, while they were doing the restriction of the carbohydrates post-exercise, to see then if it would change the acute molecular response that was associated with things. And it didn't. And the other thing that was kind of had some issues with this study was, the fact they didn't use trained athletes. And so I went into my criticism of it without really like going into the methods, but that was kind of just to kind of keep it short. And basically, yeah, because it didn't have like a really a great applied in the digest, I kind of used it as a tool to kind of discuss more around looking at molecular markers and what these studies that look at molecular markers after exercise can tell us. And I basically said, like, had they seen an increase or upregulation in these molecular markers for mitochondrial biogenesis, like they hypothesized they thought they would, had they seen that, it still wouldn't have been like the end all be all. It wouldn't have been, we would still have to have some caution about it. We would still have to like weigh the study pretty well against what you're already doing. And it'd be really good for hypothesis generating, I think. So had they seen that, that this mitochondrial biogenesis was occurring, then it'd be really nice to see a training study. And obviously the gold standard or the, that is going to be, if did they see some kind of performance increase, But also, like, it would make sense to do a muscle biopsy after that intervention to see if they actually saw changes in mitochondrial biogenesis or see the content. And so anyways, so that's kind of like, I just, like I said, the study didn't really do much for me, but I think it was a good study to kind of just like say, like, hey, these are things to kind of consider when you are in the absence of a training study. You know, some of these molecular markers are kind of nice to look at, because sometimes it'd be really hard to do the intervention that they're talking about, even though it'd be easy to do it in real life with a cyclist. And I guess that gets into the next study that I looked at, with the, where they looked at the training and the 4-hour training intervention, where they 4-hour training event intervention in both situations, but in the experimental condition, they used sprints, and I think there was like 12 sprints or something like that. And this study differed in that it was very applied, and they were using elite cyclists. And so here I look at it. So the caveat here is that I didn't get a chance to look and see if this author had done a training study after this, because generally, like, this is almost certainly from somebody's PhD. And he has, I think, a study that was built off of this, that the same people in the study, he just described different analyses and different physiological things that were going on in the study in another paper. And usually the way PhD programs work out is that there's either like a very small study, like a questionnaire study, a very small, easy to do kind of acute study. And then there's like a bigger cross-sectional study. And then at the end, most of the time, they're doing some kind of training study. If it's not that, then it's like 4 or 5 like acute studies. And so I didn't get a chance to see if he actually followed up with a training study based off of, on this, because even if it wasn't published, he does have his thesis up and you can download that. You can go in and check that out. But so I'll just discuss this as the results that are given here. Assuming that, and I guess I'd run this by Osiris, is in terms of, you know, how easy would you think it would be to do a training study like this on someone that is trained, where you would probably, maybe you're incorporating 2 or 3 4-hour rides a week for one group, and you're telling them like you have to just ride in zone 2 the whole time and you're coming into the lab for that long. I think it'd be really hard to do, but maybe he did it. But anyways, looking at the results of the study, you see that there's a difference between the molecular markers that came out of the two conditions. And just to kind of, in layman's terms, and just kind of remembering it off the top of my head, when they had the sprint, they had more, you know, kind of strengthy kinds of adaptations. So like things that would lead to hypertrophy in the muscles. You have more of that. And then in the other instance, if I remember correctly, the one that was just 4 hours at zone 2, then they seem to have more a mitochondrial aerobic kind of adaptation, if I remember right. So, but that's not to say that one didn't have an aerobic adaptation to it. So I think that the sprint might have had a slight decline. But again, like when you're talking about molecular transcription factors, you do not know if that's going to translate down the road to not only to the proteins that are going to come about out of it, but is it actually going to translate into a performance change? Or so for this study, like is interesting. So again, I would have to, before before I would really get into it with an athlete, I would have to go see if there was a training study. But it does add some nice little like hints to what you're seeing. And one of the things that I mentioned in my review was, you know, this decline, potential decline in transcription factors for mitochondrial biogenesis. That's actually been linked to, in at least rats, maybe humans as well, increase in muscle acidosis. So this, I don't know how much, because there's, you know, you'll have these old school coaches that say, do not, you know, when you're doing your long rides like that, do not ride really hard. And they've kind of tested this, and there's some evidence to show that it does potentially affect, mitochondrial biogenesis.
But they did 30-second sprints, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did 30 seconds, like 12 of them or something like that. There was 4 hours, three of the first 4 hours at the end of them. I think there was three or four of these 30-second sprints. So it was, I think it was like 12 total or something like that. I'm at 100%.
Because for me, like growing up, it was kind of like, don't go over 10 seconds if you're going to do a sprint on an endurance ride. Mm-hmm. So the 30 seconds starts to drag that out a bit. And this is, I guess this is what this is trying to see what happens.
Because mm-hmm. at 30 seconds, you're getting into bioenergetic shifts. 10 seconds.
You're moving out of ATP.
Ten seconds typically, and this is based off of like Wingate data. So it might be a little bit different when you have everything kind of warmed up and moving, but like the first 10 seconds the ATP production is coming from like stored ATP and phosphocreatine, and it's not really getting into carbohydrate metabolism yet. So and then so that 30 second is getting closer to, you know, burning into more carbohydrates, and probably, and it's just starting that crossover into potentially an increase in aerobic metabolism. But of course, you got most of aerobic already. So, yeah, it was an interesting study, and I have to like kind of think about how I'd want to put it in, because it's not to say that, and I think I pointed this out in my thing, was to say like one, it's not to say that either of these are better. The question is like, how, knowing this, how are you going to implement them? Do you just have long periods of time in over a month where it's only one, or primarily one, and then you put in the other one with the sprints? So then it gets back down to like the a lot of this is just going to be in the hands of the practitioner.
What do you think, Cyrus?
Yeah, I was saying, it's just going to be how you can actually implement that and how you can combine it in, because like for less and less cyclists now, there's the long base period of no racing. Like that sort of seems to be becoming a thing of the past, because the pro season is getting longer. There's only the 2 months now without any races. And then, yeah, you see obviously cyclocrosses, there's plenty of riders that are doing both and not showing any signs of being worse off for it. And then obviously me being in Australia, I come back and it's crit season here when everyone's doing their base training over there. And like for me personally, I'll do those few weeks of purely aerobic stuff, and then I'll just throw, like at the moment I'm doing a mostly aerobic block for the next month, with all of that just real steady state stuff. Like for the last 5 days, I wouldn't have done anything over 500 watts kind of thing, like really avoiding doing any sprints at all. But then each weekend I've been doing a crit each Sunday, which is going to have about 20 sprints in it. So I think, even though the main target is that aerobic thing, so still I don't want to lose the top end while I'm doing that. So it's really hard to find studies on how much you'll lose the aerobic gains from doing one or two sessions a week, because like you, it's, those kind of studies are sort of almost impossible to write up because there's just so many variables that come into play. So I think for that kind of stuff, epidemiological stuff, and just like accessing that huge Training Peaks database is where we actually end up getting more info on what causes what adaptations in terms of the big picture training stuff.
And it could be one of these things where, let's say in an average week, like you have an interval session with sprints and you're not really thinking about maximizing your mitochondrial development in that day. And then you just, and then maybe all you need is like 1 5-6 hour ride on the weekend. And that's all the stimulus you need just to get the mitochondrial development for the week. And then it's just a matter of like, instead of having this idea, this thought of like, because muscle acidosis might, you know, interrupt mitochondrial biogenesis or whatever, well, maybe that's fine if it happens a certain amount of times of the week, as long as you have that one really long ride that would stimulate the mitochondria. And you just, it's just a matter of like, how often do you need to see that, just to kind of continue stimulating it.
That wraps up part one of our discussion. If you're interested in part two, where we discuss a little more on heat training, because there is a couple of really solid articles that came out, then become a member of SemiPro Plus. Details and the link to purchase are in the show notes below. It's time, once again, for The Chaser, the segment of the show where I talk about something that is probably unreleased, untested, or has nothing to do with cycling, but this week it does. And it's an indoor training app called Trainer Day. A cheeky name, but clever enough to get a pass. And if you downloaded this app, the experience wouldn't feel dissimilar to any other training-focused indoor apps out there. I had a talk with founder Alex, and it's an interesting story. It also gives us some idea of where this type of platform is headed. A community-generated database of workouts. Alex acquired this database, and it wasn't long after that people started requesting an app to use the workouts, and so Trainer Day was born. Now we get to the interesting part. As soon as I saw this product, with its huge free offering, which includes 10,000 plus workouts for free, a training plan creator, and 20 free workouts in the iOS training app, I started to see where training content is heading, straight to zero, where the actual workouts become a commodity. Now, I remember deep discussions at Vertigo about the number of training plans and training workouts to offer, what the market wanted, and what was available at the time. It wasn't anything near 10,000 plus workouts, but we still had this overarching idea that revenue for training content would eventually disappear as this content was commoditized. And so here we are. Alex is certainly aware of this, and even his paid version of Trainer Day, which increases the ability to sort, send, and instruct the user, is only $3.99 USD a month. Bargain. So where are we heading? I will say it'll take people much smarter than me to figure this out. But without throwing around general terms like machine learning and AI, we're heading towards curation, recommendation, and personalization, taking these large databases of workouts and training files and learning from them and you to make recommendations that build towards the goal you want and give you the recommendation every single day. I won't say exactly what Trainer Day is doing in this space, but we've seen Trainer Road already roll out their version of what they think the next training world will look like. Even Training Peaks has rolled out experiments in this area. And without getting into the details, their goal here is to make training simple and deliver this at scale. So it's just a matter of jumping on the bike when you want to train and loading up the day's session. Now, my final comment on Trainer Day is they must have a similar idea of simplifying training because they rolled out a feature that does just this. It's a WOD feature, and for those non-CrossFitters, WOD is Workout of the Day. This feature is aimed right at me because it pushes workouts from Training Peaks into the Trainer Day app so you have the workouts ready to ride when you need them. The workflow for a coach or a self-coached athlete is you can push workouts from anywhere, whether you build them in Training Peaks itself or you push workouts from Trainer Day into Training Peaks. So then you can plan and build with a performance management chart, for example, and then automagically the workout of the day will appear in the Trainer Day app ready for you to ride. This isn't a unique feature in the training space, but it does bring Trainer Day in line with the major players and adds a valuable feature for coaches and self-coached athletes. It also shares my vision of what training technology will help athletes and coaches achieve, and that's to make the process of training as frictionless as possible, so you can just get on with doing your best performance every time you're on the bike. And with that, Ride Better, Faster is written, hosted, and scored by me, Damien Roos. You can check out more episodes at semiprocycling.com. Until next time, ride well.